Good afternoon, colleagues. Most welcome to Data Days. This event this afternoon is part of a series of events organized by the Mission of the Netherlands this week. Earlier, we organized an event on how data, information, and intelligence can help UN peacekeeping missions achieve their mandate. That was very interesting. We had another event yesterday on measuring progress in the field of peace and security. And today we will discuss data for the SDGs, monitoring post-2015 progress and implementation. This event this afternoon is organized by the UN Foundation, Leiden University, The Hague Campus, and the Netherlands Mission to the UN. And the central question for this event today is quite simply, how can data help in achieving the SDGs? And I'm very pleased that we have an excellent moderator, Henry Bonsu, who is a media man. And also we have lined up a great panel with Claire Melamed, the lead author and secretary of the Independent Expert Advisory Group on Data Revolution for Sustainable Development, which issued this report recently called, very fittingly, A World That Counts. We have William Hoffman here to my right of the World Economic Forum, Ulrich Mans of Leiden University, The Hague Campus, Njeri Kababeri of the Center for Multi-Party Democracy in Kenya, Ivo Havinga of the Statistics Branch in UNDESA, soon to be called the Data Science Branch. No, I'm just kidding, but nowadays we talk more about data than about statistics. And we have Samantha Custer of 8Data. So that is the panel for today. I would also like to acknowledge Mintu Pham of the UN Foundation, who will deliver the closing remarks this afternoon. So Henry, may I turn this over to you?
Peter, yes, thank you very much indeed, and greetings to all of you. I've been looking at the list of delegates, and we have people from a wide variety of backgrounds. It's a real global representation. We have the Australian mission to the UN here, permanent mission of Kenya, the New York Times, lots of people from UNDESA, Germany, Egypt, World Health Organization, and you're all here because you believe data is the new sexy. That's great. I'm absolutely delighted that so many of you are attracted to this topic. I am too, not just because they flown me here from the UK, but as a media guy, as a former BBC reporter and researcher, we were bombarded with data and statistics. Many of the reports that were sent to us ended up on the cutting room floor. Some of them didn't even make it that far. But those bits of statistics, those bits of data that did make it to the television news or online, were those that told a story that we could measure and that we felt the audience could understand, that would track, say, their living standards, that would tell them something about the way the world was changing, something that was robust, something that was accurate. And these are the kinds of things that hopefully we'll be able to feed into the next hour and a half. Being a media person, and I always say this at the beginning of any UN event that I'm chairing, I'm a very, very simple man, a humble man, born in Manchester, of Ghanaian Ashanti stock. I'm privileged to be here. But many of the concepts that you, with your big brains, are going to bombard us with in this chamber are going to blind me. And if they're going to blind me, they'll be blinding some of you as well. So I encourage my fellow panelists to speak in primary colours, to leave us wanting more, to inspire us, to tell us a story, to plug the gaps, and to make us feel this is worthwhile. Shortly before I came over here, I had a meeting with the general manager of a hotel who I'd met at another event, and I told her what I was going to be doing today, and she said, yes, these UN meetings, do they really add up to much? Do they really make any difference? And I said, well, some do, and some don't. And I hope the one that I'm going to be chairing today will make a big difference, because it's coming at a pivotal time, so panelists, delegates, don't let me down, okay? Do I have your support? Oh my God. Do I have your support?
Yeah.
F- thank you very much. Now, one of the reasons why this is very, very important is because there's a degree of disappointment that's been building over the past 15 years with the lack of good, robust data generated by the Millennium Development Goals. We've had reports from the Open Working Group on Sustainable Development Goals. We've had reports from the Intergovernmental Committee of Experts on Sustainable Development Financing. We've got this one, A World That Counts. How many of you have seen this document before? Some of you are very nervous. Some people are holding it. How many of you have read it? Who dares summarize in 30 seconds what it says? Raise your hands if you dare summarize in 30 seconds what it says, what it means. Right. This shows, Claire, the extent of the task before us today. So let me introduce my first speaker. So Claire Melamed, Secretary of the International Expert Advisory Group on the Data Revolution. Claire, as you can see from the response here, a big task. You believe, from your tweets, I see this, revolutions do not begin with reports. So what do they begin with? And how can you sell this report so much to the people here that they'll actually read it and understand it? Over to you.
Thank you. Okay, I was slightly nervous before. I'm even more nervous now. So thank you for that. Revolutions certainly do not begin with reports. I think it's probably fair to say that the data revolution started some time ago and very far away from the rooms of the UN and from government statistical offices. And the data revolution has actually been going on for some time in private companies, among NGOs, among a whole swathe of people who've been kind of experimenting, innovating, doing all kinds of exciting things with data. And to some extent, the conversation that we're having now is a bit of a catch-up exercise, where we are pulling in this exciting conversation, all of the new opportunities that exist, and trying to understand how we can use that for, you know, without wanting to be too grandiose about it, for the global good, and how we can start to take some of these things, which until now have been really focused on a few niche and very specific initiatives, and broaden them out and bring them into service to help solve a much wider range of global problems. I think, you know, to some extent, the reason why this concept of the data revolution has caught on has been because it's been something of a sort of a process of catharsis for many of us. For a long time, those people involved in the MDGs have been throwing around lots of numbers. You know, we're two-thirds on the way to this. Malaria has dropped by X, maternal mortality by Y. And we've been saying these numbers with quite a high degree of confidence. And I think it's something of a relief to all of us to be able to finally say, well, actually, you know what? We know a lot less than we think we know. And a lot of these numbers that we have been using and have been relying on to tell us what's going on in the world are a lot less robust and a lot less certain than we would like to think, because we've been operating on a basis of actually much less information than we perhaps have all been prepared to admit. And everyone's had this sort of known this privately, and I think the fact that now we're able to all say this openly and it's become part of the political discourse and people are really starting to invest time and energy, and we hope eventually resources, in doing something about it comes as a huge relief, I think, to a lot of people who've sort of known this and not really been able to talk about it. One of the things that we found when we started to look in detail at the figures for the report is that there's no period in which we've had more than 70% of the data that we've needed for monitoring the MDGs during the lifetime of the MDGs. So really, we've never been that certain about what's going on. And also, you know, obviously, the things that we don't know aren't a sort of random selection of things that we don't know. The things that we don't know tend to be the most neglected issues, and the people that we don't know about tend to be the least powerful, the most marginalized people. So there's a sort of general problem about data. There's a systematic problem in that the sort of gaps in data preventing us from solving some of the most critical problems and the most neglected and the hardest problems. So I think that's really where this whole excitement around the data revolution has come from. We've got a problem that we're all finally admitting to, and we've got a huge opportunity, because there's a whole, you know, there are sort of vast oceans of data washing around the world every day now in a way that they really weren't 20 years ago. And really, it's just about bringing those two things together. We've got a problem. We've got a huge opportunity. How do we start to bring the two together and help to bring all of these new opportunities to bear on these problems that we're trying to solve?
Claire, before you finish, would it be fair to say that nearly 15 years after the MDGs were launched and with all the data that was available in 2000, for us to be in this position at the end of 2014, it's a pretty poor show.
You may say that.
What's your comment?
I think we do have to hold up our heads and say, yeah, we absolutely could have done better.
Who's failing?
Who's failing? A whole range of, as ever, I think it would be nice to be able to point to one simple failure, because then we would be able to say there was one simple solution. Alas, things are never rarely as straightforward as that. I think it's been a failure of governments to not invest enough in data. I think, you know, for those countries that are dependent on external resources, it's been a failure of donors in not investing enough in data. I think it's also been a failure of international institutions and donors and others in not making the best use of the data that we do have. Mm-hmm. So insisting on, you know, five different types of household surveys that can't be combined together, when in fact if everyone got their act together a bit earlier, we'd been able to put all the data together and it would be much better. So it's always complicated, but I think the answers are more money, a bit more coordination, and, you know, as we can see from the number of people in this room, the main answer is that people start to care about this. And fortunately, I think we're definitely there.
Who cares about this? Some people say yes.
Not everybody.
Some,
that's a bit
not
worrying.
Quite sure.
Are you in the
If you don't
meeting?
Care about it, yes, why are you here? Seriously. Okay, Claire, thank you very much for that. Yesterday, I hosted an event for the lead department within the UN Global Compact, and it's amazing how much data the really, really big corporations have about their consumers, about the countries they're working in. And you indicated, Claire, that maybe they're ahead of the curve. Let's try and respond to that when we hear from Bill Hoffman, the head of data-driven development at the World Economic Forum. People say the private sector is already using data very successfully. What can governments, what can the private sector and other agencies learn from the way in which the private sector uses data?
Thank you, Henry. And let me echo everyone's appreciation for everyone that could come here today. I think in terms of the business perspective, perspective I've had after leading a global dialogue on how data can be used in a variety of contexts is that this issue is highly complex. And as much as we love and hope and have very high aspirations for this, there's an equally strong shared set of anxieties. And like any tool, it can be used for good or bad. And so I would say from a business perspective, one of the elements that shapes and frames their engagement, the way that they will use and leverage data, is the discipline of risk. And understanding a way of how the risks in using the data can be more effectively understood. And so the element that I've heard of in the conversations that we're starting and will continue to lead at Davos and other places is how can we have a more practical and pragmatic set of ways of understanding the impacts of using the data and measure those against the harms, which extend way beyond privacy, so that we can identify the harms at the individual, the community, and the national level, and understand those that are most likely and most severe. To look a little bit into the issue of the recent Ebola spread, there was a very conflated and complex set of risks that were creating a very long and drawn-out process for simply using the data that everybody knew could help save lives. And so that from a tool perspective, what we need to do is unpack some of those risks and obviously recognize those risks that could hurt us, but to maybe ratchet down the anxiety that they're simply not that probable. And so that's an abstract concept right now. The work that we're doing at the Davos is to really get those questions into the discipline of risk management and to understand some of these intangible harms and start to be much more specific in terms of identifying the likely and severe harms and then putting the energy against that.
And being specific, Bill, in headline terms, remember, I'm a media man, and if I was going to think of putting your report that you're going to launch at Davos at the top of my bulletin, I would want it to be snappy. I would want it to be punchy. I would want people to understand what you mean. What are you going to be telling people in Davos in January, in headline terms?
Sure. We have to fix the data deficit. More data needs to flow to the Global South. We need better data ethics. We need to understand how and why these impacts are delivered. And most importantly, we have to start with the individual, that this is ultimately, as Claire mentioned, about the most vulnerable and serving and upholding their lives and dignities, and that is the central part of this discussion.
And what would you say the big private sector companies who take risks, who know a huge amount about their markets, their emerging economies, where they're doing business, what are they doing that some of the other groups who are complaining about the lack of accurate data are not doing?
I think what you'll start to see is a shared understanding of very specific issues that can be addressed. So disaster response, disease outbreak, specific things that are acute and where the failure to share and link data comes in very tangible terms. I think that will start to show that collectively we can share. Through the work of this group and the leadership of the UN, I think we can also start to frame that at a long-term evidence-based policymaking, that the data that can be shared and linked from private sector can help us build the world we want by better measurements and better data usage.
Okay, Bill, for the moment, thank you very much. And if you have questions for Bill or Claire, do hold them. We'll be coming to you shortly after we've heard from our speakers, all of them. On to Ulrich Mans, who is from the Leiden University campus, The Hague. That's the Center for Innovation there. Ulrich, what about the new thinking? How do we measure what has not been measured before? Because we've heard about the problems, and they're still here after 15 years. We need new thinking. We need enlightenment. You are an academic. You are paid to think big. Please tell us the fruits of your labors, because we need your help right here.
I see what I can do. The data revolution hasn't really come into the universities. Speaking from a social science perspective, and we're a social science faculty, so we sort of observe the world, and we've been looking at statistics, obviously. And now you see this, well, let's call it data revolution, coming up, and everybody talks about Twitter and Facebook and GPS, CDR data, et cetera. And what we do see is that pretty much all the students, not all of them, but a majority of them, is really, really keen to find out what this means. So I'm not a fan of, let's say, predictions, but if you look at the kind of student population we have, the people coming into the first years and studying international studies or public administration or international affairs, they will use data much more than they have in the past. We have the average anthropology student learning R programming language in the evening hours. That's a fundamental shift to how this type of educational branch used to operate. We simply don't have the teachers yet to actually do this. What I'm saying is, basically, you have this youth bulge being able to digest the new types of data streams, and we want to facilitate that. How do we do this? Let me take up your call and saying, talking about primary colors, let me take primary letters. A, B, and C. We do see A, authorities and public institutions bringing up data. That is a large amount of data becoming available that didn't used to be there. That's one major stream. B, we see businesses. William alluded to this. Businesses are becoming onto the scene saying, hey, you know, this is a gold mine. We know we can sell it, but we can also do other things with it. Let's explore under certain conditions. And C, civic data streams. That is whatever comes out of people trying to connect people with digital devices. It's much easier than any time before to actually create community platforms, collect data, different data, whether it's type early warning systems or consumer data. You can do that decentrally. You don't need to wait for Visa and MasterCard to bring you that type of data. It will come bottom-up as well. So what we want to be doing is make sure that whoever is interested in this data revolution is part of the movement to think about new ways creating data as well, because we think that the C, with all due respect for the A and the B, the C is much more forceful because it's much more resilient. If you have thousands and ten thousands of data generators out there, particularly from the global south, it's much more interesting than to have 100 large companies with which you sign up individual contracts, which is useful, but we're seeing C to be a really bottom-up drive, and that's what we're investing in, and we see that the students are really keen to actually take that up.
Mm. Big problem is, with all this data, how do you know what to measure and what not to measure? What is useful, exciting, new, and what is basically white noise, background chatter? Because a lot of people don't quite know what they should be measuring, so they track almost everything and come to no conclusion whatsoever.
It's one way to find out. I'll borrow a term from Robert Kirkpatrick, saying build to learn. I think that's a nice way of phrasing it. Yes, you have to think through what you're doing, but there's no way to find a theoretical answer to it. And I think from a university point of view, we're really at a threshold here. We have to operate differently than we used to. We have to build theory based on experiments. That is a new way of thinking. At the Center for Innovation in The Hague, we actually do that, and we apply that to the rule of law, peace, and justice themes, because that's where the practitioner's knowledge in The Hague is. And you can do that to the Millennium Development Goals, the SDGs as well. It is exactly the same movement. You have to make sure that you build and you keep reflecting. And keeping in mind what William said as well, the ethical standards. We don't have the ethical standards. We don't have the arrangements. We don't have the common language we still need. But we can build it. We can build it, and we have to ensure that, in our case, the academic community makes sure that there is an inflection moment continuously built in. And that is possible.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed. Now, our next speaker has been described as an humanitarian gold medalist. Yes. Also described, however, by one of her major newspapers back home in Kenya as a prophetess, not honoured in her own country. That's a shame, but we're going to honour her here today. She has a platform on this stage. She is the executive director of the Centre for Multi-Party Democracy in Kenya, Nyeri Kabeberi. Can you give us some practical sense of what is needed in Kenya and countries like it for political decision-making? Because some people say data, statistics are political, especially when some people have it and others don't. Over to you.
Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to be here today. I'm going to use this opportunity of 4 minutes to give two examples, one on education and one on women. Both are former Millennium Development Goals until 2015, but also I think they are both going to be in the SDGs. The first example that I want to give from a political perspective is on education, and I want to use two governments in Kenya that used two different gave two different promises to Kenyans. One was President Kibaki. He gave a promise on free primary education. And indeed, 8 years, 10 years later, we do have graduates from that free primary education. What is not clear is whether there had been enough data collection done to show how expensive this program was going to be for Kenyans, but nonetheless, it's a successful program, and it is now part of our policy. The second one, still on education, is the current government gave a promise on free iPads and free laptops for all primary school students. Now, it hasn't taken off, and it is unlikely to take off. And I think the problem, again, is data information. I think there wasn't enough information to show the policy decision makers at that time when they were campaigning that we don't even have enough electricity in most of the schools, that most of the schools do not have electricity. And therefore, even if you do give laptops in those schools, students will not be able to use them, and also in those villages, and that although majority of Kenyans still use cell phones and that we have networks all over, it is unlikely that we may have network available for students at primary schools. So nonetheless, that project has not taken off. They are both very good, noble promises given for primary education. One has worked, One hasn't worked. One may have been too expensive for the country at the time because maybe other things were sacrificed, but it has worked. The other one has not worked, and it won't work on its own. It needs to work with other sectors, and I think that's that was the missing point. The other one I want to give is for women political participation. Women political participation in Kenya has been very low, despite a lot of women trying to vie for political positions. And in fact, Kenya currently stands at the lowest within the East Africa region, which has five countries, with Rwanda leading with the women participation in political positions with 63.8%, while Kenya has 19.4%, which is even lower than the regional requirement, let alone the country requirement. Now, in this case, the constitution and the law are on the side of Kenyans and on the side of women. But the electors do not seem to understand or know how to elect women. So despite the law being on the side of women, the position, we are not getting the women in those positions.
And can I interrupt you, Nyeri, for a second? Yeah. Countries are often very, very sensitive about where they are placed in these league tables of human indices. Are Kenyan lawmakers, is the president embarrassed when he sees his country, when they see their country low in this league table, or don't they really care?
Currently, I don't think the president is sensitive to this matter. He chairs the East Africa Commission currently, and despite chairing the East Africa Commission, where their second member, who is Burundi, is already on 30.5%, that the peers are not putting pressure on him, and nor is he recognizing the fact that actually, should I be speaking among equals, or really very unequal situation with Rwanda being on 63.8% and us being on 19.4%. So I don't think there is enough political sensitivity to this issue with the current government for them to realize that indeed, I don't think they should be chairing the East Africa community while the situation is looking this glaring on one of the major issues that's also a constitutional issue in our country. However, in conclusion, what I want to say is that without mechanisms, sometimes you can have a very good law, but without mechanisms to meet those numbers, we need the mechanism to meet the numbers. And that's where maybe we need to work more closely, or political leaders need to work more closely with data collectors to see how to arrive at those mechanisms that would give the numbers so that our world also counts. The other issue that I want to talk about in conclusion is that policy developers, as you heard, I work with a political organization that works with political parties, and currently we have a project on assisting political parties on policy development. And what I'm realizing now as I hear and as I come here to discuss this issue, that policy development needs to be in line with the current data and the current data analysis on the ground, because there needs to be that connection. Otherwise, policy developers give or leaders give promises that they cannot keep, yeah, because the numbers will never meet. You promise this, but you don't understand the numbers, so you are struggling very hard, and in the end, the politicians are here with their empty promises, and the data researchers are here with their data saying, you'll never meet this.
All right.
So there needs to be that connection. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Nyeri, for the picture from Kenya. Well, let's kind of broaden this and go to our next speaker, who is the chief of the economic statistic branch at UNDESA, Ivo Havinga. Your response briefly to what Nyeri has said about, yeah, and also, what do we need to do? What steps need to be taken to ensure governments are prepared to actually monitor progress on the SDGs and use data better than they have thus far?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's indeed a pleasure. You know, I'm a statistician that was working in statistics when statistics was not considered a revolution. So it's really a pleasure to be here.
But you're welcome. he survived the transition.
So I really
statistics
feel,
became data,
like
and now he's sexy.
Exactly, as your words are using. So in that sense, having said that, in Kenya, but many other countries, I think we can draw on that, you know, that extensive work that we've done over the last 70 years, when it was not considered a revolution, but really a process that we really had to take on in the hard slog to it. That said, the new momentum that we have in the attention to data is enormous for these rather conservative statistician as myself. So we're delighted, and we dance along while the world seemed to be really embracing data next to policy. But we were always talking about policy, and then we thought that the evidence would come by itself. We understand that, as you said, on my chart, the first one, where do you get your data from to come to that policy? I think that should be the first one on your chart. And I think that discussion should be had. Now, we were talking about primary colors. I think there's a primary color to be said that we have a statistical organization, the Statistical Commission, that adopted what we call the gold standards of how to do official statistics, called fundamental principles, adopted by the GA here. So, and why do we do that? Because we think that if you have statistics as compared to data for official purpose, they should be independent, they have to have integrity and trust. You have to agree on that. And there are designated institutions that has to be emboldened in still many developing countries, and developed countries in some instances, that really have to come to bear. And I think that is one of the primary purposes, and they should be well-funded to do that. We have done a lot of work on how to measure stuff, right? So it's not, you know, traditional stuff, but also non-traditional stuff. The fact that people know what they call big data, it's not that we never used big data. We did use big data, and we know how to use it, right? You know, if you look at a country like China, and you do a population census of 1 billion people, this is quite a stream of information. Then you can extend that further to mobile phone. But this is already very big, right? So it is not that big data is new. It has been part of our life, and we know how to handle that. Now I come back to the National Statistical Office, because we talked about countries like Kenya and onward. And it's not only Africa. It's throughout the world. It's a universal issue. They should now drive, in my opinion, this revolution and the central heart, because it has that central position to actually do it and has that knowledge. And where it has to drive, I think, in terms of the new sort of tools and techniques is particularly, for instance, there where administrative data is lacking, they should drive administrative data. So civil registration and vital statistics are critical if you want to measure something, you know, around mortality, around health, and so on. So it's fundamental, and we're driving it. You know, the World Health Organization and the World Bank, they're going to put a lot of money down to actually do that. There is an understanding that there is a lot of work to be done in household surveys. We have to do that by the national statistical offices and not superimpose them, well-intended, from UN organizations that collect and other donors. So there is an understanding also that we have to understand the availability of these surveys and the way we use them in low- and middle-income countries. If I may, there is also a whole new deal about new data, big data. Just by way of example, geospatial data become ubiquitous. We're going to use it, and we're using it for ecosystem stuff and so on. Now, primary colors again. If you now look at issues that we do now, we do a survey and find out what countries can do, and it's ongoing. But let me tell you, there's gold, silver, bronze, and tin. Right? And look, we will measure it today, but probably 10 years from now, you know, we have better techniques, you know, like with running, you know, those that, you know, was running 100 meters nowadays to do even faster. The gold medal, then he got a gold medal for over 10 seconds. Now he gets it only when he's under 10 seconds. But looking at the situation as we have it now, then economic data is probably the better one. You have social data, it's a little bit less. Environmental data then falls a little bit lower. And then you have this governmental data, right? That is really an issue. Now, if you have that sort of perspective in mind, then I think then you have an opportunity to develop a roadmap, and that's what we're talking about, and we'll talk about the roadmap maybe in the next iteration, in how to go about it in 15 to be ready for 16.
All right, thank you very much indeed for that, Ivo. We will indeed see where that roadmap takes us in the next phase of our discussion, but let's wind up this part by hearing from Samantha Custer. You're a tweeter as well, actually, aren't you? Yes, I've been following some of your tweets. You say, follow the money. You're tracking the investments that global development donors are making, particularly in Africa. You're looking closely at China. Actually, not the only person who tweets, so Claire does as well. And I was intrigued that William calls himself Will I am also, is that right? Will I also am, but he's not a member of the Black Eyed Peas, thank goodness. Anyway, no, that's all right. Let's move on, though, back to this stuff. You've heard what our other panelists have said, Samantha. Your response to that briefly, and then how are you going to monitor the means of implementation for what we do as we approach and then go beyond 2015?
So I actually wanted to begin with telling you a little bit about a conversation I just had yesterday with a friend of mine named Sharuk. Sharuk is a former World Bank economist. He was at the forefront, actually, of a lot of the discussions around targets for international development, from the International Development Goals to the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals. You're seeing a theme here. And I asked him, what do you think we've learned along the way? And he's told me something quite sobering, actually. He said that, okay, if you just look at the Millennium Development Goal for poverty, let's say, he said that 55 out of 160 countries have negligible to no data on poverty. Another 25 countries maybe have done one or two household surveys that tell us something about poverty since the beginning of the Millennium Development Goals. 80 countries, at minimum, don't have enough data to tell us very much at all about progress on poverty eradication. And so I think that story actually, to me, says two things. One is that a data revolution is certainly needed if we can't even actually track progress on what we've currently committed to. But beyond that, I think it also shows that there can be a gap between the rhetoric of the global standard-setting process and the actual implementation realities on the ground. So as Henry alluded to, I come to this conversation from a slightly different perspective of following the money. I track who is funding what, where, and to what effect. I want to see what kind of funding is out there for development, and hopefully to connect that into this discussion around what kind of outcomes are we achieving on the ground for sustainable development. And so as I actually look at what came out of the Data Revolution report and some of the other conversations around sustainable development goals, I see kind of three big areas of implication as we look at how you actually implement some of this stuff in real terms so that we turn rhetoric into reality. The first is not surprising, so I wanted to talk to you about financing. So much of the discussions around financing for sustainable development have focused on increasing the quantity, quality, and diversity of financing for development. And so we need to kind of find a way to actually link up those conversations with what we want to do on the sustainable development goals side of things. Because, you know, if you can actually track where the money is going and compare that to results, that's when you start to see some really interesting things happening. But on the implementation side, we have a problem. So for official development assistance, we're seeing that actually we have great granularity of information as more and more donors are opening up their information. But if we want to understand, you know, what is the role of remittances, what is the role of private foundations, what is the role of foreign direct investment, how about emerging donors like China? What are they doing to either help or hurt progress on the sustainable development goals? We need more information. The second area I wanted to talk about is this supply gap. So I alluded to, you know, what Sharuk told me about the fact that, you know, half of these countries don't have adequate information on the Millennium Development Goal for poverty. That's just one goal. How do we actually assume that proliferating out the goals that we're trying to track from 8 under the Millennium Development Goals to 17 of Sustainable Development Goals, how do we ensure that countries actually don't fall further behind? And I think that there needs to be a conversation around aligning incentives. How do you actually shine a spotlight on some of the people that are actually making progress in capturing this data? And how do you actually nudge the laggards that are falling behind in a productive way? We've seen this on the transparency of financial flows side. What would it look like to actually do that on the outcome side as well? And also sequencing. You know, this is a large reporting burden for countries to actually come to grips with. Are we assuming that it will be all of a sudden easier for people to actually report on many, many more goals than before? Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we can actually come alongside governments and donors to actually break this down and say, can you roll this out over time? And then the last thing I wanted to say is that when you look at demand, and I love the story that you shared, Henry, at the start, you know, how many reports and data sets and statistics end up on the cutting room floor? And there's an assumption I think we make that by just providing more information, that all of a sudden that's going to be useful and it's going to make its way into decision making. And my experience has been that that's not the case. I think that, you know, as we look at trying to get people to use transparent information on financial flows, there's a couple of things that need to happen. One, you have to convince people of the value of this information. Two, you need to make sure that the information you're providing is actually what people want to work with. And so I think that these are just a couple of things that I wanted to highlight as means of implementation considerations moving forward.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Samantha. So we've heard from our six panelists. We'll hear from them again. But I'd like to hear from you brief comments or indeed questions. We're presuming that everybody followed that and appreciated it, digested it, and is now going to take their thinking further. But I see a sea of some interested faces, some faces that are nonplussed, some faces that appear to have switched off, and some that are lean and hungry. I would like to take the lean and hungry faces first. Who has a response, a strong response to what they've heard? Who needs clarification? Who just wants to make an intervention at this point in response to what you've heard? I'm just looking at this whole sea of day-to-day's faces. Ah, lady over there, yes? Please tell us who you are as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I am Queen Mother Dr. Deloise Blakely. I'm the Community Mayor of Harlem and the Ambassador of Goodwill to Africa. And I've done a little studying at MIT, Harvard, Columbia University, and a Fulbright scholar. The question that I raise for you, and hearing this discussion or debate, whose data are we looking and going to use for adaptable and applied for developing countries? Because I think that's very, very important. Who's doing it? And why should we accept
it? I sense your question is laced with suspicion. What are you concerned about?
I'm concerned because when you look at adaptable applied technology in itself and understanding a little bit about the geek world, who do we really trust when you're talking about the data if you're not driving it from civil society on the ground? And many of us do not go further enough to study and understand, even if we're on the superhighway.
All right. Thank you very much indeed, Queen Deloise from Harlem. Anybody? Yes, gentleman right in the middle, and then lady behind you. We'll take a cluster of three. Please tell us who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. My name is Kashambuzi Eric. I'm working with the UN Foundation, but I'm going to speak in my personal capacity because I haven't been cleared. I think that data revolution is needed the most in countries that currently don't have the institutional and human capacities and are experiencing brain drain, most of them. How is this situation going to be reversed in the next 15 years?
Thank you very much indeed. And the lady behind you, yes, hello, tell us who you are. From?
And I like your C, the civic data streams. Obviously, being from Mushahidi, I believe very strongly in community supply data. But just looking at you and looking at Bill, hi, Bill, how are big organizations helping those individuals and communities that you want to supply data to collect, to store, and to control their own data?
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, so you addressed that. We'll start off with your question, Sarah. You addressed that, was it to Urish and to Bill, was it? Okay, yes. Okay, Bill, you start first.
Sure, and maybe I'll bridge to the first woman's question as well. I think the notion of trust is one of the fundamental elements that needs to be better understood and articulated. And I think in terms of the dynamics of what I'll call the current, what has given us the last 20 years of the internet, is the asymmetry in who has the data and who is instrumented by it, to use very grand and lofty terms. From my personal perspective, one of the attributes of a data revolution is that individuals are not only viewed as consumers of data, but producers. And so that if we view individuals as producers, then they become an entity in the supply chain with commercial rights, legal rights, and we're simply not on the wrong side of a one-way mirror. And so I think that will start to strengthen the efficacy, the agency, the utility of how services and solutions can be brought to market where the individual is actively engaged. And that is a very long-term vision. So I would say in the near term, the questions around the utility, the understandings, how can we strengthen the literacy in how data is bought, sold, served in a very, very complex ecosystem so people can understand is a priority.
Before you go on, Deloise, are you satisfied by that answer? Or do you need more?
First of all, I am Queen Mother. And I represent 55 million displaced Africans,
okay.
And been around the UN for about 46 years as an elder.
Yes.
I don't hear the answer, but I think let's continue the dialogue.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And the second part, that was Sarah's question. How are big organizations helping? Eric, would you want to handle that?
I would say they don't necessarily have to. I could imagine that Shahidi has had various experiences in trying to get companies to help. What we see is a very thriving community of organizations that do it, be it as being a small company by themselves or civil society organizations, using technologies for their own means. And that is becoming much cheaper, and it can be financed without corporate support. And I think we will see in the coming, let's say, 2 to 5 years, we'll probably see different alliances coming up where companies start engaging with civil society organizations because they have a genuine interest in saying, hey, in this community or in this area, in this nation, we want to improve things in some sort of way, and we want to make sure that we have access to people who can make a difference, and not necessarily through our own network. And that is both for Global South and the North. And I think even in OECD countries, there's a genuine interest by large corporations to understand what they can do with their data because they know it's important data. They know it's valuable, but they're very reluctant to just sell it off, for example. Or those who have tried have been told off as well because they've run in trouble. Maybe one quick response to you regarding the role of civil society. I mean, we basically developed a rule of thumb. The moment you have one unit of energy into data science, you need to have three units of energy in interpretation thereof. Because for data scientists are trained to take a one as a one no matter what. That's an important thing. But
sorry, 1 second, Ulrich. Is everybody getting this? I'm just looking around.
Thanks for asking.
No. It's important because obviously you're in a center of innovation. Mm-hmm. You're there in a university. We've all got our expertise from a variety of backgrounds. But I want to make sure that people are getting everything that's being said here so they can
rephrase.
So they can find it useful. Please rephrase that.
If you have one data scientist looking at data, you need three people to tell that person what it could mean if you put it into a certain context. In data that has been collected by the World Bank, as we heard, means something very, very different from data that lies in a bank because people have made a purchase.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure that you have people on board who can engage in a dialogue saying, hey, this one might not necessarily be a one. You know, what kind of data are we looking at? The veracity of the data, the trustworthiness of the data. You have to find a new breed of professionals that can bridge the gap between these two, and we don't have them yet.
Okay, new breed of professionals. Let's have a look at one or two other questions. This one came from Eric, and he says, this data revolution, or even basic data, is needed most in countries that have experienced brain drain, countries that are really struggling. Who wants to take that? How about you, Claire?
Okay, thank you. I mean, this is one of the things, obviously, that we talked about at great length in the experts group on data. This is one of the kind of critical inequalities that is developing over data, and one of the reasons for action, because the inequalities will just carry on increasing unless something happens, which is between those countries that are equipped to handle this, to know more, to use what the data exists and gather more, and those who aren't. I mean, I think there's a kind of boring answer and an interesting answer to that question.
Give us the interesting one.
No, I was going to start with a boring one, actually. Sorry.
Okay, as you wish. Just close your eyes for 5 minutes.
I think part of the answer to this is the boring, long slog of capacity building, of investment, of building literacy, of education, of all the things that we were doing before data became sexy, but nonetheless are just as important now that it is sexy, and in many ways more so because we have more data to play with. So there is a boring, long-term, unglamorous slog answer, which is critically important, and we mustn't forget that in all of our excitement about shiny new things. But I also think there is a potential here, in some aspects, not in all aspects, for a certain amount of kind of leapfrogging. And of those governments, those countries where they don't have the kind of, you know, they haven't yet built up the institutions to provide an answer to every question, where they can jump over some of the systems that were built on traditional methods of data collection and start to innovate and to start to create institutions that are more geared to the world of data as it is now, rather than the world of data as it was 15, 20 years ago. And we've seen that once already, you know, in the last 10 years with mobile phones, that we have countries which have leapfrogged straight over a sort of landline system and have just moved straight to mobile communications. And I think we can learn to some extent from that and see what we can do with institutions and with data as well. So that's the interesting bit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do either Njeri or Samantha have anything to add to that particular point? Njeri, you do? Yeah.
I could add something. I'm thinking that sometimes it's not the lack of institutions and human capacity or even the brain drain, but actually the acceptance by political leadership that data is important. Because even sometimes when you just do small surveys on who's winning and who's not winning, it's always rejected. Who's going to win and who's not going to win, it's always rejected. So I think the acceptance, because most of these countries, you know, I come from a developing country, we have universities, several universities, we have, you know, scholars who are always producing this data, but are politicians ready to accept this data as true and real? That the issue of trust, therefore, and trustworthiness becomes important for people to be able to use the available data to connect it with policy decisions. And that, I think, is what is lacking sometimes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for that round of questions so far. We'll get another round in a moment or two. But first, there are a number of respondents in the room, people who've indicated that they're keen to say something, speak to this topic. Let me hear from, do we have Robert Kirkpatrick, who's from UN Global Pulse in the room? Where's Robert? Ah, yes, okay. You've heard what we've been saying thus far and some of the interventions. Your response, please. What do you want to say?
It's exciting to see this conversation and to see data at the center, as Ivo said. I think, you know, I was a member of the independent expert advisory group that worked with Claire on the report, and I think one of the interesting aspects of the report that caught many readers by surprise was the fact that, especially in the executive summary, you can't even tell what kind of data is really being talked about. It described the need for different stakeholders to step forward and begin making investments and catalyzing the emergence of an ecosystem around data that applies to data in general. And I think what we're now seeing that is new is this recognition that it's not just data is something that exists for the sake of your health programs or your education programs, your food security and job creation work, that there are horizontal innovations that need to be made all across the board at all levels. From ethics and privacy to technical infrastructure to new kinds of public-private partnerships. But digging deeper, generalization becomes perilous. And I think it's also important to understand when we look at these new kinds of data, they are fundamentally and radically different than many of the kinds of data that we used before. And they have very different risks associated with them as well as different opportunities. Big data...
Do you think the opportunities outweigh the risks?
I do believe the opportunities outweigh the risks, but only because I believe that the risk can be mitigated. Mm-hmm. I think that when we look at big data is a new natural resource, but not in the way that, let's say, sunlight or wind are natural resources. Think nuclear power. Big data is the new plutonium. Its nature in its raw form is to leak, to contaminate. It can be very harmful to human life. If we understand it scientifically, if we can contain it through a new kind of engineering, we can harness it to power a city. We can use it as a public good. But we have to mitigate the risks in order to be able to use it safely and responsibly. It's fundamentally different in what it allows you to do. We think of big data as, surveys are essentially photography. You take a snapshot of a living system and you walk away with it and you have a momentary understanding of the state. Big data is like video. It's produced all the time in real time.
Constantly renewing.
Constantly renewable and renewing, and it allows continuous observation of human behavior. Mm. Observation, it's empirical data. Behavior, it lets you see what people are doing in response to your policy or program change, and that can allow you to take continuous corrective action to get results sooner. It allows a different kind of organizational process in driving sustainable development. Other things that are different, you don't own it.
Yeah.
This is data that's owned by the private sector. Whether that's the right way we want the world to work in 10, 20, 30 years, whether citizens should ultimately own and control use and reuse of that data, that's an important conversation. Mm. But today, the reality is the private sector owns it. And it's not clear as a practitioner in one sector or another that it's your turf.
Yeah.
Your survey data was yours because it was collected to understand employment or collected to understand food security.
But once you put it out there...
But this data on population movement or spending patterns, that data doesn't belong to any sector. And what you need is innovation to discover how to adapt it and apply it to your own world so that you can use it to change the outcomes.
Okay.
Also, I have one question at the end briefly, but what can be answered later. But I think the issue of trust that Bill raised is absolutely fundamental. The social contract around big data has been broken. We need to rebuild a new social contract, or if some have
done it. Hang on, how's it been broken?
Well, I think what we've seen through Snowden and other recent events, I mean, people were alarmed before these kinds of revelations about what private sector might be doing with their data. The understanding that the data can be seized and then used in ways that no one had anticipated, with very little insight into how that is happening, that has left a lot of citizens concerned. And that's doing is it's leading to the development of regulatory frameworks that are so driven by how do we mitigate the risk to privacy that they're not creating the space for innovation and learning how to apply the data to sustainable development.
I want you
goals.
To land there. You had a brief question, did you?
Yeah, I think one of the issues is getting businesses involved. And Bill had talked about how do you mitigate the risks in developing a risk management framework. But I think to get business to get involved in this, it's going to take more than the opportunity to give and have social impact, and it's going to make more than just it's going to require more than their just understanding how to mitigate the risks. How can we motivate businesses? How can we create the right incentives for them to invest in both sharing the data and helping support the innovation around it for shared value?
All right. Before Bill responds to that, let's hear from Martin Sherman, who's an ambassador, a UK mission to the UN. Where's Martin? Ah, yes. Hello. Let's hear what you have to say, Martin.
Well, thank you, Henry. You've surprised me slightly because I wasn't expecting to be called upon to say
anything. Your name was floating around before the session.
Well, that's tremendous.
It was in the data, you know?
It was in the data. I suppose, first of all, this is really exciting. I think if we're, for this, we talk a lot here about a new ambitious agenda. But to come back to what Claire was saying at the end, we can't even measure the agenda we have at the moment properly. So there needs to be a clear advance there. So this is hugely exciting. I think the question I have really is around our ability to absorb data. Now, there's lots of data out there, that's without a doubt, but you need to turn it into something that's usable and people can act on. And therefore, the question of what you're measuring, of how you actually interpret it in a way that governments but also people can act on, is hugely important. So it seems to me there's a big piece to join up between the sort of the technical expertise, the possibilities of new technology, but then turning it into something that's actionable. And that, I think, is still hugely challenging, not just for developing countries, but also actually for developed countries. So, you know, to come back to an old problem of information overload, how do we get beyond that? And in order to get beyond it and to have a usable product that helps us all, how much can you feasibly measure? Now, it's hugely fascinating to take a video of everything that's going on in the world. Cool, you know, wonderful. But actually, you need stuff to act on.
Yeah.
So what are the kind of proxies? What do you actually look at?
Yeah. Thank you very much. And finally, in this phase, do we have Massimo Tomasoldi here? Who's yes, hello, Massimo. And you are a permanent observer, is that right, at the International IDEA? Thank you very much. Your thoughts?
Thank you very much, Henry. In my previous job, I actually was at the OECD. At the time, the International Development Goals were being discussed, and I remember that at that time, and also during the development of the MDGs, there was a completely different process. Actually, there was a focus on targets, measurable, and then a movement upwards by aggregating them into goals and then disaggregating them downwards in indicators. Now we have witnessed a completely different process. We have very ambitious sustainable development goals. So some of the panelists actually have questioned to what extent 17 SDGs can serve the purpose. But we have seen a process that is what we were calling for. I mean, getting back to what Jerry was saying before, we had policymakers that defined the priorities. And therefore, now we need to look at what can be measured as a consequence of that priority setting. We are not really looking at what can be measured and then aggregating them into priorities upwards, which is a correct way of proceeding, but it is very challenging because many of the things that are, from the policymaker's point of view, important are difficult to measure. And some countries do not accept, actually, that they can be measured. So there is not even consensus on that. And I don't see very much the way forward in that respect in the next 10 months. So that is very interesting. For my current position, I deal with democracy and electoral assistance. And in general, my main interest is in the democratic accountability in the management and design of monitoring systems. To what extent these are in the hands of experts, in the hands of specialists. To what extent citizens may have a voice in not only, producing data that can be used by these specialists, as Bill rightly said, but also in influencing the type of data that are considered to be relevant, precisely because the definition of the goals has been political. There should be a voice for citizens for doing that. Thank you.
Massimo, thank you very much. So as a result of our three interventions, we're highlighting concerns about motivation of business. How to motivate businesses to share what they have, because they've got amazing details, data research about their consumers and their future consumers. How do we get beyond information overload? Martin's brain seemed fit to burst, and you need assistance, and we'll see what we can do about that. And then Massimo's wondering where the citizen's voice is in all of this, influencing the agenda. Let's see. We've not heard from Ivo for a while. Let's... Ivo, don't opt out, you know. You're still involved in this. Yeah. Which of those? Perhaps the information overload, because you spent your life in this statistical silo, and you've now come out for air, which is good. We can see you. But
you can see me finally. Yeah.
We can see you finally. But, I mean, the information overload point that Martin was making is a serious point. How do we address that?
Absolutely. The overload is when you do not know what the question is and for what you collect the information. So I think the point is you have to have a question in the sense of policy, what you want to measure, and you go after the source that allows you to do that in a very cost-effective and efficient method. By way of example, you can do a forest inventory, which takes you about 5 to 10 years to do in any country, or you can use the ubiquitous available remote sensing information. These are two different options that you have. You can spend a lot of time in developed and developing countries training people to do that, and I think you should, for ground truthing, but at the same time you can also teach them other sort of techniques. That data is available, and increasingly we know with the new satellites going around that we can get resolutions that are very important. Now, with that resolution, I just continue the example. This is not only important for official statistics, how we want to measure, but it has to do with reputational risk of large global companies about, and increasingly so, about 30-40% of GDP in most developing countries at the moment is generated for those that are linked to global value chain. Agriculture, manufacturing, and services, which is important. These companies are very much aware of reputational risk of their brand, right? So they want to know where the palm oil comes from. They want this information on land cover maps. They want to know the concessions that are provided. We can, and that is also happening, we make these maps. For instance, the World Resources Institute has forest maps, water risk maps. You can layer on that information from the NGO that go there and find out whether they held themselves to that concession, because they can put a picture on whether that indeed is happening. So you find that merger of information on the one hand of information that the corporate sector desperately wants to have because they are very much aware of that reputational risk. You find that link with the NGO because they also want to know whether their community is best served in terms of that supply chain and the employment. And you get the official statisticians that draws in the aggregate for policymaking at information that is really real-time available. Now, that's by way of example that you really see that you start working on new sort of environments that that you can apply.
All right, thank you very much indeed. Massimo raised the question of the citizen's voice in all this. Samantha, perhaps you need to intervene here.
Sure. I might do a bonus add-on to what Ivo described on the information overload piece, though, first. And so when you asked that question, Martin, I wrote down three words. One was visualization, and that's exactly what Ivo was talking about. How do you actually present information in different ways? And one is maps, layering that allows people to capture it at a glance, and that makes it a lot easier to navigate than going through tons and tons of spreadsheets or PDF documents. The second one I wrote down was disaggregation, and that's a theme that came out a lot in the report. But you know, the information that you want to have depends on where you want to, where you sit. And you know, if I'm a citizen in a community somewhere, maybe what I want is just information on clinics in my community. Can I actually filter through and bypass all of the noise to get to that? But if I'm a donor, you know, in Washington, D.C., maybe I want a different level of analysis that I can go to. And so having that flexibility and adaptability with the information that people can just filter right down into what they want is critical. And then the third piece, and I think this goes to something earlier that was mentioned, the importance of infomediaries, that, you know, we talk a lot about data, and if you're a statistician or a data scientist, you love data, but, you know, for most people in the real world, they're interested in information. And so, you know, sometimes citizens doing that on their own, that can be overwhelming, but if you can engage civil society, the private sector, the journalists and the media, can they serve a role in actually helping to take this noise of data and turn it into information? So on the citizen voice piece, I'm really glad that you mentioned that. So one of the things that concerns me when we talk about building more and more supplies of data is that to what extent are we thinking about the end users, the prospective end users of our data, and actually thinking about the types of data that is most interesting to them? So, you know, from a citizen's perspective, we should be taking that voice into account in terms of understanding what are the questions that you're trying to answer, and what kind of data would you need to be able to answer those questions? We should also be asking, you know, national statistics officers or line ministry officials or donor officials. And so I think, you know, thinking through the use cases is kind of the jargon, if you will, of saying, okay, who are the faces of the people that I want to use this data, and how do I match up the data I'm providing to that. So I would absolutely agree. I think citizen voices are key in this process.
Samantha, thank you very much indeed. And there was a question from Robert Kirkpatrick. How do we motivate businesses who've got all this information, all this data, to engage with and indeed share what they have? Several of the businesses that I was working with yesterday at the UN Global Compact, they were talking about corporate sustainability. They're willing, they're keen, but they may be the minority of businesses. So let's hear from you, Bill, on this.
Sure. So just to echo the comment about trust, that underlies good business in a variety of ways. So in the spirit of where relationships could be strengthened, where there's existing interest, the conversations that we've been having over a number of years right now tend to fall into the following buckets. There's clear and immediate need in disaster preparedness, resilience, elements that we know are coming with climate change, and there's a variety of opportunities there. Clearly in health and disease prevention and alerting, that's another class of areas where there's a very strong interest. And lastly, logistics, transportation, being able to move goods and services more effectively is an area where you can get increasing leverage and tremendous value in a variety of ways. So that's the what. I think what's really interesting is how we get there, and I think that's where the beginnings of these conversations is really starting to plant a seed. Right now, business and governments typically don't talk. How many people are here from business today? Not a lot. So my point is we need to have
hands over there. Okay. We may come to you next.
Good. Okay. So in terms of an engagement, a process is simply understanding what some of the core priorities are. And if I was going to be a little flip, focusing less on solving the problem, the general problem, and let's find one problem, and let's start to understand and how we can build a scale around that. And one last comment about what I think will give us the leverage and the containment and the trust is that when you look back at the industrial age, right, it was steel that allowed us to took fire, which had been around for thousands of years, and do stuff with it, right? In this new era, which is really about understanding social norms, values, and elements, contract law, as hard as it is to believe it, but lawyers actually could invent our new steel. And by redesigning and innovating in the way that contract law is deployed, scaled, innovated, made accessible to everybody, then I think we have a structure for how we can understand how data flows. This is an intangible, non-rivalrous good. It's different than this thing that we're holding. And so we need to understand how we strengthen trust with intangibles. So if there was one message I was going to walk away with, is that contract law could be the steel of the information age, and we need to understand how that can be scaled first. Then we can understand regulations. Then we can look to a variety of ways. There's tons of contracts out there. Good services, trust happens in many, many ways. So for an area that we could look at in the near term, I would say, let's look at how our supply chains work today and use that as a starting point.
Well, thank you very much. We're into the home straight of our discussion this afternoon. We've got about another 15 minutes left, and I don't want anyone to leave this room feeling they had something really powerful to say about this subject of data and as we approach the SDGs, but we're not given the chance to say it. So let's see if we have the business people. I'm looking at you. If you have something that you feel you need to say, you have a contribution, speak now or forever hold your peace. If not, yes, lady over there. And please tell us who you are.
Thank you very much. My name is Sabrina Juran, and I work with the United Nations Population Fund as a technical specialist on data and research. UNFPA is a member as well of Paris 21, the global partnership on statistical capacity development. And so on behalf of them, I would like to make reference to the project they have embarked on about a year and a half ago, which is called Informing a Data Revolution. This project, or the aim of the project, is threefold. One, they conduct a country assessment of statistical capacities and take stock of the supply and demand and gaps that are defined in the national statistical systems. In order to address these national gaps, Paris 21 identifies technical and institutional innovations that have been piloted in some of those countries. And as a third aim, they're drawing a roadmap for the implementation of the data revolution at the country level within the next 5 years. So I think that is actually something that we could maybe also hear from the panel on how to actually implement that at the country level. So what has emerged so far, some of the key points that came out of the project so far, is we heard that at the beginning when you asked for where did we fail or what was the failure, is that coordination or lacking coordination within the national statistical systems, underfunded projects or underfunded operations, and missing leaderships are basically the main challenges in the field. Second, data collection processes should build on country systems and improve alignment between global monitoring needs and strengthen national capacities. And then thirdly and lastly is that innovation related to new technologies and new forms of cooperation between the public and private sectors should be fostered to leapfrog statistical capacity building at all levels. So this is what has emerged so far. The project is going to be presented.
So this is what you fed in. Has anybody listened to you? Has anybody responded to you from either within the UN family or from outside, or is your report gathering dust?
The report will be launched.
Oh, it's not been launched yet. Okay. I ask this because I know quite a number of people in the UN system and the UN family, and a lot of them complain that nobody reads their reports. So, am I right? Am I lying? You know, people need, if it's all very well doing the reports, people need to read them and act upon them. Otherwise, we'll keep on reinventing the wheel, and that's going to be wasting everybody's time while people are needing action. Yes, gentlemen over there. We'll respond to your point, by the way, Sabalina. Somebody there as well. Okay, gentlemen there.
My name's Dr. Leon Perlman. I'm an independent consultant and at Columbia Business School. To Bill's point about the private sector owning data, there is a tension, I think, between data security and openness of data. And you're seeing a lot of companies now in the commercial sector who are encrypting data in the form of tokenization. So this is more of a technical question, but how do you reconcile use of data with the need to secure data?
Thank you very much. And then, yes, over there.
My name's Jeff O'Malley. I'm the Director of Data Research and Policy at UNICEF, one of the international organizations that supports those big household surveys that were talked about earlier in the panel. There was a lot of pessimism expressed early in the panel about failures and shortcomings of the last 15 years. I'm a glass half full kind of person. And when I look at the growth of data and how the growth of data has driven real successes in the lives of real people, in child survival and in education and other areas, I see a lot of hope. I'm interested whether any of the panelists can reflect on beacons of hope in the public sector in particular. Which countries are beginning to get it right in terms of, from a public sector point of view, the collection, the analysis, and the use of data, whether industrial or developing, what are the models that the rest of the world can use as their revolutionary aspiration?
You asked the question, do you have some countries in mind?
I do, but I'm interested.
Okay, we'll see if we know what you're talking about. and then there was a gentleman. Was it the gentleman with the glasses? Was it? No, okay, he's not listening. You go. Too late, you go. We may come back to you.
So my name is Paul Walsh. I'm a visiting academic in Columbia University from University College Dublin. I'm going back to something that Martin, I thought what Martin really said, but yeah, People picked it up differently. And this is the data that we have fit for purpose. And when I look at the traditional data sets the statistics office are collecting, like on companies, you said it's good economic data, social data from households, environmental data, government data. The problem is it's not interoperable between each other. So if you ask me as a researcher to go into a sector like agriculture and you say, well, what, give me an analysis of a particular intervention and show me its social, economic, environmental, cultural, political outcomes, I'll tell you that's kind of difficult because the data sets really aren't that linked, right? So that puts pressure, I think, on us to think about how when we create ways of collecting data that we do actually can, at a micro level, address these issues. And I think it goes back to, I think it was Kevin here that was saying that, Robert, that, you know, really the government shouldn't really be the ones designing, collecting, spending all the taxpayers' money. Maybe they should take a step back and be the regulator, be the monitor, be the standard setter, and somehow create platforms to let the private sector and all the individuals and give them carrots and sticks to populate the data properly so that we can do that type of research. So this was two things that I was linking in the conversation.
A government to step back, really, from this. Yeah.
Rather than somebody who's taking full responsibility for implementation.
Okay, yeah. Gentleman with the glasses there.
Daniel Schensel from the UN Population Fund. I'd just like to highlight some contradictions that I've heard. You know, we've heard that the academic community isn't yet equipped to teach the students necessarily. We've heard that the statistics community may feel that a lot of this is already being done and has been done. We've heard that there are just no development data in a vast number of countries. And we've heard an interesting analogy to the nuclear arms race. And I would just like to suggest that maybe we've had any number of nuclear explosions go off already. The economic crisis was perhaps in some ways a big data crisis. The LIBOR, and the Manhattan Project is not in government. It's in Google and it's in Goldman Sachs. And I just wonder, you know, the governments have proven that they're not equipped to regulate the financial sector. It feels that this discussion recognizes some of these contradictions and that we may be in trouble. Thank you.
Oh, dear. We may be in trouble. And finally, gentlemen, behind you, yes? Please put your mic on.
Yep, it is there. Sorry. Hi, I'm Lawrence Yanovich, the president of the GSMA Foundation. The GSMA is a network of 800 mobile phone companies. We aggregate arguably the largest trove of data for mobile. And we really don't know how to be engaged with the international community effectively on this question. We're very interested in learning how mobile can enable the sustainable development goals. But I think the private sector doesn't really have what may I call handles or what are the protocols into the system, into the process where we can come up with some big initiatives together.
Thank you very much. Okay, so a series of points and questions here. So Lawrence, how does the private sector engage? Looking for a way in, really. That's what you're kind of saying. Daniel basically just wants to quit planet Earth. He's had enough. Paul wants government to step back. Jaffa, looking for beacons of hope. Which countries are getting it right? Leon highlighted the tension between data security and openness. And then Isabelline, is that right? From the UN Population Fund. You're bringing out a report soon, aren't you, I think? But you feel there's a lot of, a lack of coordination, lack of leadership. People need to use country systems more. So a lot, and this is going to be our final round of responses. I'm looking at you all to see if you are craning your neck eagerly for one or more of those questions or points. I'll see if there's a natural fit between, let's have a look, tension between data security and openness. Ulrich. That sounds like you. Your microphone, please.
National security and openness. Definitely. I mean, we basically said, you see that big data has entered the scene and it's been applied in the intelligence community, the Snowden effect, if you will. It has been applied in the commercial sector when there's billions of dollars, depends on whom you believe, running around, and it's going to increase. And we basically said, we need to build the third pillar, and let's call it big data for humanity. And really, it comes down again to the idea of trust. Something has to happen that the individual Facebook user or Twitter user, whoever it is, to appreciate what can be done, then it's useful. And at this point, the Lighthouse projects on national level, on village level, simply do not exist to the extent that that is the case. And maybe I'll take quickly the Lighthouse nations as a follow-up. I think, very interestingly, Senegal and Ivory Coast, who've collaborated in that case with the Data for Development Challenge, that is an interesting case. It goes away a little bit from the discussion about how national statistics offices should leapfrog or do things differently, but these countries have said, let's try something else. And that, I think, is very, very interesting, and I think we should all look at that and learn from it and see what we can do from that. One thing I just wanted to be a little bit provocative to you, sorry about that, and maybe responding to Martin and the information overload. Overload we already had. That's not going to change. Making it actionable, I think one of the key things we should be asking ourselves, aren't we making enough maps already? I love maps, and we engage in map making as well, but you know, looking at the amount of maps that is being created at this point based on big data, we need a separate Google for that very, very soon. And I think if you want to make sure people are going to start looking at whatever you're finding out using data, make sure it's not only on a map. Make sure it translates into something actionable. And there are ways of doing this.
Thank you, Ulrich. Let's have a look. Stop making maps. Countries which are getting it right. Jaffo is concerned, so who wants to take that? Countries which are getting it right. Yes, Claire. And then Yeri.
Okay. I'm glad you raised the point about the sort of glass half full side of this, because I think it's absolutely fair. You know, we tend, obviously, in discussions like this to focus on the problem because that justifies action. If everything was fine, we wouldn't need to be sitting here. We could go out and take a nice walk in the sunshine. Yeah. So I think, you know, we have to focus on the problem in order to build the sort of politics around solving it. But I think you're completely right. There are all sorts of amazing examples going on. And I think that was one of the really exciting things about the experts group is just, you know, hearing from people about all of the amazing things that are happening around the world, not least, in fact, within UNICEF and all the different things that UNICEF is doing around new innovations and some of the great things, which I won't go through because you can find in the report. But at a country level, the two things that have really struck me recently is, first of all, what Nigeria have done, and I'm afraid it does involve a map, but I think it is pretty amazing in terms of bringing together lots of different data sources. And I think that's really what we're talking about here. So they've created this map where you can home in on a particular, you know, you can home in on the, you know, really sort of very specific district, and you can look at that at what health services exist. You know, you can look at the local clinic and see, does it provide maternity services? Does it do vaccinations? You can look at a school. How many teachers are in the school? I think it was, in fact, Columbia University was involved in building this as well. It's absolutely incredible. And it's been created by bringing together information from household surveys, from satellite photos, from other sources of data. And I think there are some brilliant examples of where we are getting it right. And just to answer also, I just wanted to pick up on the question from GSMA, and I think it links with some of the other questions about how do we do this? How do we implement this? How do we reconcile openness with privacy? You know, how do we make sure that the kind of question about using the data better, linking up all the different things that we do? Because it's not always a question of creating more and more data. It's also a lot of this is about we've got the information there, we're just not using it very well. And I think the answer to a lot of those questions is, unfortunately, we don't quite know yet. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this is about experimentation and trying it out and trying out new things. And I think that's one of the real messages of the report is what we need to do is just kind of get on with it and just start to experiment a little bit.
Tremendous. We're slightly over our time now, so I'd appreciate it if you could be extremely brief. And Jerry, your response to that, countries which are doing the right thing.
Just a quick response, and I'm not quite sure that it's related to data, but I wanted to quote the Mo Ibrahim Index on Good Governance that's consistently produced every year, and you find that there are some countries that are on the top three or top five all the time, like Mauritius, Botswana, Seychelles. They are very consistent. They're always among the top, so they must be doing something right, and this something right could be related to data.
It could also be related to having a very small population.
It could also be it could also be related to that, but we also know of other countries.
That's what my Nigerian friends tell me.
We know of countries with small populations that are also doing very badly in terms of governance and democracy. True, true, thank
true,
you.
True. Excellent. And let's see if we can just pop up one or two other thoughts. The UN Population Fund point. Lack of coordination, underfunding, leadership. But that report hasn't come out yet. When it is, I'm sure, it will be read by you, Samantha, yes?
Yes, absolutely. I'd be very interested to read it. I think your focus on the importance of country assessments to look at gaps between supply and demand are very much on point. And it's something I tried to emphasize earlier, which is, you know, countries are at different starting points. They have different levels of capacity, different issues in play. And so how do we have the flexibility to almost come alongside and customize, you know, a response plan for that? And that's really critical. I think that the lack of coordination piece is really an issue and a lack of leadership. I think that, you know, this is why connecting the dots between the resources and the outcomes is so critical. Because if you can start, you know, starting to look at all of the resources that are being put into development in a particular country from the country's perspective, then you start to provoke coordination. So, and this ties into Jeff's comment about who's getting it right. So Nepal is a good example of this, where Nepal is a situation, you know, from the financing for development standpoint, they actually were able to take all of the information on aid in their country, compare that against poverty indicators, and actually have a conversation with the donor community to say, look, one of the poorest districts in our country is completely being overlooked by the donor community. We need to actually, you know, get this right. And it was the country itself the government itself that was at the seat driving that conversation. And so, you know, I think getting the resources together with the outcomes, giving the government something that they can actually drive the conversation is really key. So I'm glad you raised that point.
Okay, thank you very much. I have a couple of closing thoughts from William Hoffman and Ivo Havinga. William, and particularly maybe that point Lawrence raised, Lawrence from GSMA, still looking for a way of engaging.
Find a problem and then smoke out the lawyers and get to work.
You sounded like President George W. Bush when you said that. Smoke out the problem, smoke out the lawyers, get it done.
No, I think the issue is there's a number of incentives to slow down and drag things out and find every simple risk that possibly could come up. And I think if we can start to more effectively identify the likely and severe harms and identify how those are different in a digital domain versus a tangible domain, I think there's a lot of opportunity to move more quickly and to use those approaches then that we can start to scale up. I think in terms of the specific ways that industry can work together also is sitting together and talking. I mean, that comes from the World Economic Forum, but I think there is a gap right now in understanding the shared needs and concerns. Individually, I think you could line up a room full of executives and everybody would emotionally say, yes, there's an intent to be there. And I know a little bit about the mobile operators. I've sat in the room with a number of them. The passion is there. They need a path forward in concrete and measurable ways so that we can actually start to work together. So I think part of this is dialogue and just bringing the communities together.
Thank you very much. And finally, Ivo, just sketches out a roadmap briefly for the future, because 2015, we're all going to be talking about this and we're all going to be looking at what the leaders sign come September 2015. We want to do better than we have over the last 15 years. Please, in a nutshell, sketch out that future.
The roadmap is that we will have. Well, it sounds boring, but you need expert.
That's
groups.
Not a way to sketch out a future.
And
why
and
do
the
people always say that? It sounds boring.
You know, there is basically on the indicators, and if you, I'm looking at it from the SDG perspective, right? I think that's what the roadmap you mean, not in a broader sort of data sort of arena, because there's many more players in there, and we talked about that. But in the SDG framework, there is to be established an expert group, an interagency expert group that we had for the MDGs that will be now transforming in an SDG framework, and they will basically start, you know, turning out, you know, the indicator sets that we aspire to have. That work will be done. In a nutshell, the first sort of meeting will be in February, and then we will go to what we call the Statistical Commission in March 2015. They will meet again somewhere in the fall to basically flesh this out. This is a significant operation with a lot of UN agencies and other agencies that work together in putting these indicators together. And then we will bring that to the Statistical Commission in 2016 for further sort of endorsement. In that process, of course, there is the need to bring that to the General Assembly as well to get that overall sort of endorsement. Now, that is the roadmap. But let me indicate that In terms of the work that we're doing, there's a lot of work around, for instance, population census that will restart. It is not anymore that you do it by the form. National Statistical Office were major fire hazards in any capital because they were always hugely collecting all these forms. We have moved away from that to a large extent, and that really helps up speeding it. The way we collect forms in terms of surveys from businesses and households, in the past we did everything through paper. That's all moving to handheld devices. Now, with these new technologies, we can process it much quicker. We can do it also much more easily. And there are good examples. The SDGs sort of wave that we're going to write on that data revolution should bring a lot of new sort of energy to this this case that we can evidence-based policy. And I think we should write that crest, and we should not stop talking about it coming 2016. This is something that has to be pushed forward. And I think with the ubiquity of information and data more generally, this will not move away. Data is basically the new way we're going to drive our economy and our profits, right? Yeah. What as steam and electricity was during the Industrial Revolution, it will be data for the years to come.
Thank you very much, Ivo, for that passionate conclusion. And let me thank also the other members of the panel, Samantha Custer, Inyeri Kababeri, Ulrich Mans, William Hoffman and Claire Melamed, and Peter van der Vliet from the Kingdom of the Netherlands, who organised this alongside the UN Foundation and University of Leiden campus, The Hague. Thank you very much indeed for your engagement, for your participation, and hopefully you'll take this away and use it as we build up towards September 2015. Thank you very much and have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.